From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
And I'm Scott Greenberg. This morning we speak with Scientific American senior editor Jen Schwartz, who highlights moments when science has reversed itself from the promise of plastic to debates over the life in the universe.
Then we speak with mathematician and author Eugenia Chang, who explains why equality is never as absolute as it seems, not even in math, and how rethinking sameness can transform the way we approach fairness in everyday life. These guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peek.
Today, we're diving into the fascinating theme of science turned upside down.
Scientific American recently published a collection of vignettes called Upended, edited by Jen Schwartz, who is a senior features editor at Scientific American. It highlights some of the most striking reversals, pivots, and course corrections in scientific history.
From the promise and peril of plastics to cosmic U-turns about the fate of the universe, these stories remind us that science isn't about certainty. It's about self-correction. Jen Schwartz joins us to talk about what we can learn from science's greatest U-turns and why embracing uncertainty might be the most scientific act of all. Jen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Jen, as we know, life isn't always linear. And particularly with science, sometimes it's two steps forward and one step back. I'm curious, you put together this amazing collection of vignettes of scientific U-turns. What inspired you to kind of delve into this and make this collection? What do you want us to kind of learn from these scientific U-turns, if you will?
So I think, you know, obviously it was our 180th anniversary at Scientific American this year. And so that's where the 180 came from. And, you know, we thought the play on words there would be an interesting starting point for a collection of stories to celebrate 180 years of covering science. And as we started talking about this as a team, it's tricky, right? Because a 180 might say something to one person and it can have a sort of literal interpretation, but it's the way that science corrects itself. It happens in all different ways. It really is more like, is it a zigzag? Is it an upheaval? Is it turning something on its face? Is it more iterative? And for this, you know, issue, we really wanted to focus on more of these sort of more dramatic or more substantial changes in our understanding and show that this is a good thing. It's a good thing when science corrects itself, and it's a good thing when we learn from our collection of knowledge rather than something that's negative.
Do you have a favorite that you want to share with us? I mean, you know, there's some really great stories in here, and I was shocked to learn about several of them. I was like, wow, I didn't know we got that wrong and then got it right. But what are a couple of your favorites?
So I wrote a essay about plastic, and I actually come from a plastics family. My grandfather was a plastics engineer. And so I grew up as a kid really, you know, seeing this product that he was fascinated by. And my mom is an environmentalist. And so I sort of stumbled upon this idea that plastics, which of course are now hugely problematic in the way that they do not decompose, in the way that they pollute our world, in these fragmented nanoparticles that are showing up everywhere. We think about plastics this way, of course, now, but plastics were also this thing that really changed our society and changed our world. And I realized that how they got started was really because of a sustainability issue. There was a billiard ball company in New York City that was looking for a way to replace their ivory billiard balls with a different material, because ivory, which comes from elephant tusks, was sort of hard to find or becoming really expensive. And the idea was, you know, could there be something made out of a synthetic material instead. And that was back in the late 19th century. And so I think it's really interesting to look back at how, the synthetic material that was created to replace something like ivory or tortoiseshell, it really became something that was totally not sustainable and deeply harmful to the environment. And I think that arc is really important when we look at any new technology that we bring to the world, something that looks really promising and that it's going to solve something, but it doesn't help us escape the limitations of our natural resources.
Yeah. It's so funny. Every time I, read something new on how we all have microplastics in our bodies, how you can find microplastics, at the highest reaches of Mount Everest in the snow. I just think back to that scene from The Graduate, the movie with Dustin Hoffman and his I think a parent's friend was saying, the future is in plastics. And when there's all this scientific research surrounding innovation and forward movement that seems so promising, that word you use, the arc, is a very interesting one. Do you feel like with plastics in general, because you've been so close to it now, it's just part of the scientific method, if you will, to finally, we come around to it wasn't the greatest thing. In fact, maybe it was the worst thing. Is there something we could have done differently?
It's a great question, and I think this is one type of the sort of upending that we write about in this issue, which is that, certain technologies do feel inevitable. Plastic did, of course, do a lot of wonder for our world, and it made, a lot of products cheaper and more accessible and things like that. And maybe we would have gone in that direction anyhow. And I think you can compare it, somewhat to what we're dealing with AI right now, which is that, this is here, it's happening, and I think we're doing a better job recognizing all of the potential problems that it might bring as well, that it has, potential to help and potential to harm, and that's any technology. How do you anticipate it, regulate it, think about it? And I think we're doing a better job sort of thinking about that now. Whether or not we regulate it well is still to be seen. But I think that's like one form of this type of reversal that we're talking about here. It's not that we should have never created plastics or never created AI. It's sort of the ways that we talk about it or approach it or apply the tool. How do we, it's really out of the hands of science at that point. And so I think there's other examples in this issue where you really are looking at a field of science where there are updates and information that change within the field itself. It's not so much about how it lands in the real world.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jen Schwartz. She's a senior features editor at Scientific American. And we're talking about an article, sort of a compilation of vignettes about science's greatest U-turns. And I want to just reiterate this notion of 180 years at Scientific American, Scientific American being the longest running magazine in this country, and I believe the second in the world. You've been there a long time, Jen. Tell us why you believe that Scientific American has had this staying power.
I think because we've had many iterations of the magazine, some people, still think of us as this journal, which we are not. We are very much a sort of popular science magazine geared toward an audience of just curious people who want to understand the world in all of its complexities and all of its awe. And I think, we've had varied, eras of the magazine that respond to what's going on in the world. For a while, we really catered to people who were inventors and, wanting to share their creations for patents. And sometimes we covered science in a much more academic way. But I think nowadays we are really interested in showing how science shows up in everyone's lives, as well as telling you about the latest discoveries that are just really cool, In and of themselves. And so we have a mix of scientists writing for us and journalists who are also investigating science. You know, we are not just celebrating science, capital S, as like an institution up on the hill. We really do also like, you know, covering it from a place of journalism. And I think that's what has made us so successful.
This is a wonderful package of stories and examples. And it highlights how politics, economics, and culture can really amplify or even delay some of these about faces. But, you know, these reversals can also feel a little bit like whiplash, you know, particularly to the public. I'd love that Scientific America can address these, but I'm curious, how do you think scientists and scientific journals, particularly like Scientific America, should communicate evolving knowledge without undermining the trust of what we put in science itself? I think it's, you know, lately it feels like it's been at risk.
It's so true. You know, when we set out to do this, you know, part of me always thinks, is this a good time to be doing this? We don't, you know, you can imagine saying like, of course science corrects itself, or it was wrong and now it's right. And someone cherry picking that and using it as a way to say, oh, we can't trust science. But I think we have to also just trust our audience and understand that science has always been a process of self-examination and iterative updates. I mean, that is when it's working well, that is how it works. I mean, if it always stayed the same, it wouldn't be a good thing. And so I think, you know, there are some stories in this special report that really get at the heart of that. You know, for example, we talk about how our thoughts about the cosmos have changed over time. You know, is the universe expanding? Is it contracting? Is it doing so slowly? Is it doing so very quickly? We have thought all of those things at certain points, and we're still a little bit unsure what is going on. We also talk about the rising role of RNA as opposed to just DNA being like the key to life. We talk about our search for extraterrestrial intelligence and various times we've thought something might be there and then it's not. And then there's a lot of, you know, like you said, more practical day-to-day updates, such as, you know, the recommendation for mammography for women. At what age should that be done? I mean, we can look at, you know, various things that happened during COVID, how we update information in this like real-time acute situation where the stakes are very high. And I think there's a lot here to dig into and to understand why it can be tricky to be living in uncertainty. I mean, we all talk about how hard it is and we all just want black and white answers. But when you really, you know, sort of trust and work within the framework of science, you have to be comfortable with there being, you know, sometimes a lower degree of uncertainty, but sometimes a high degree of uncertainty.
I think scientific research demands a certain amount of humility and that, you know, you're able to admit your mistakes. One of the famous stories that I remember, and it wasn't that long ago, but I remember in the 50s and 60s that physicians thought smoking was good for you. Now, that may have been an economic, cultural thing, particularly promoted by the tobacco industry, but you had scientists, you had physicians in white lab coats appearing on TV talking about how smoking was good for you. And then, of course, you know, boy, that was a huge about face in the 70s, what we learned when the Surgeon General came out and said, no, it's probably not a really great idea. We think it's kind of linked to this thing called cancer and other terrible lung diseases. And I'm just curious what you think about, you know, when researchers are trying to correct their own about faces. What's do you have a story in your package where science has said, oh, you know what, not so fast. Maybe we got that wrong.
I think the story that leads off the special report by Charles Mann, which really takes a broad view of all these different types of upheavals, if you will, is a good place to look at that. And he says essentially there are sort of two forms of how these reversals take place. There is one where in a field that's relatively young. There, you know, the information might be based on certain assumptions, and the researchers are looking for something, and they're looking for it, and they're looking for it, and they can't find it. And oh, maybe that's because, you know, it's something else. And these types of sort of more dramatic reversals are often in that context. And then there's a second type, and I think this will be familiar to a lot of people, which is when the information itself becomes so sort of huge and important and affects our world economically, affects it politically, it has an element of power. That is when information can be, you know, manipulated and taken out of context or deeply exaggerated. And that is often by people who are not scientists, who take scientific information and use it, you know, to accentuate their own perspective and try to, you know, do it for their own gain. And I think that's what we deal with quite a lot. And you know, we have several examples of that in Charles's story and throughout the issue. And I think that's, you know, what we're most familiar with today. But I think, you know, there are different types. It's not just about, you know, sort of exaggerating evidence in that context.
Yeah, good point. So, as you reveal in this article, humans are not so special. Really? We aren't?
Right, there's such a long history of trying to set humans above sort of all other species. And I think this is a lovely article by another Scientific American senior editor, Kate Wong, just about how there's all this new research into the ways that animals are much more like us than we used to think. For example, you know, an orca whale that had made headlines because she mourned her dead calf for, you know, like 11, 17 days. And there was all of this like thinking of this is an example of grief. And then there's been more examples of that appearing in other species, including in monkeys and in elephants, but also in donkeys and even ferrets and others as well. And I think, you know, we're also seeing other animals show signs of thinking and feeling. They show reactions to pain and going into different environments when they're in pain. And in 2024, dozens of scientists, you know, signed this declaration acknowledging that species quite different from us might have experiences of consciousness, and that, you know, this should possibly be considered in decisions that we are making that affect these animals. And so I think this idea, you know, was always considered sort of a faux pas to anthropomorphize animals. But in fact, they might have much more in common with us than historically we thought.
Jen, earlier we touched a little bit on the concept of whiplash, and we as consumers or just people who are curious about science trying to figure out what's right, what's wrong, where did we make the U-turn? Where do you think social media plays in all of this? I mean, I get blasted all the time with some of the craziest notions that people actually buy into. And I'm just thinking, well, wait a minute, that doesn't completely make sense. That's not what I think science is trying to tell us. But then we get somebody, and usually it's somebody hawking some product or, you know, nutritional supplement. But social media has really kind of been playing into this huge concept of science whiplash.
I mean, social media is sort of the worst place to make sense of science in a lot of ways because it is so short and there is so much turnover of content. And I think the reality is that in almost every case that we talk about in this special issue, and when it comes to science, like true whiplash rarely ever happens. There is rarely this super dramatic moment where a scientist throws their hands up and says, everything we thought we knew is wrong. I mean, you know, we can go back to the mammography example or so many other examples in here. We're talking about, years or decades of thinking about something and going back and forth. And so when a new recommendation is issued or there's a new way of thinking, we're not talking about, you know, a moment that happened the day before and then everything got updated. So I think the way that social media presents a lot of these updates is, of course, not accurate to how we got to understand them. And, you know, I will just say that I have reported quite a bit on the effect of social media in the past and the way that it is designed, of course, to overwhelm and stimulate us and outrage us and make us perk up and go, whoa, I didn't know that. I should pay attention to this. And, you know, if anything, I would say that, you know, to be very wary about that and to stay away from that mode of thinking that, you know, like one day we're not getting enough protein and the next day it's fiber and the day after that it's don't eat any meat ever. And so I think it's a way to sort of maybe find interests and curiosities and go from there. But anyone who is, you know, pitching whiplash, scientific whiplashes on social media, you know, that might not be totally accurate.
Well, social media is kind of society's sugar, and I am somewhat addicted. I do find myself outraged and from time to time thinking, how could this possibly be? But there it is. And I guess the best advice is let's just ignore it and rely on Scientific American for our wonderful science reading. I'm looking ahead, Jen, if you had a crystal ball, what fields today might be on the cusp of their own dramatic reversal? What's tomorrow's evidence showing us course corrections today? Any thoughts on that?
It's a really interesting question. I sort of report on, personally, and in what I do at work is I think about how, you know, we are adapting either well or poorly to these changes in this our rapidly changing world. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the term whiplash, and I'm thinking about, for instance, how all around the world, we are, a lot of places are dealing with a whiplash between drought and having extreme rainfall. And this is, of course, a pattern that we are seeing more and more due to our changing climate. And I think if anything, you know, we can talk about the ways in which climate science has been completely manipulated by a sliver of the population for their own economic and political gain. But I think what we're going to be seeing is that, and we are already seeing this, is that a lot of the research coming out of climate science is that it's all happening maybe a bit faster than we thought it would, and that the consequences will be stranger than we thought that they might be. Or even not that we got it wrong, but that it would be hard to anticipate all the ways that climate change and its effects will alter our worlds in ways that are hard to predict. And so I think, you know, we'll be looking at all of the ways that we see changes in our environments and our health, in our ecosystems. And I think that'll be a fascinating area of just sort of rapid updates over the next years and decades.
You heard it here first. We're going to be keeping a close eye on climate science. We've been speaking with Jen Schwartz, senior editor at Scientific American, talking about Upended, a series of vignettes showing how science evolves through reversals, surprises, and second looks. If you'd like to explore the full package, you can find it at scientificamerican.com. And remember, the next time science seems to change its mind, it may just be doing exactly what it's meant to do. Thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio, and until the next time, stay curious. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Math is most often equated with equations, from the most basic like 1 plus 1 equals 2 to the exceptionally complicated. It is often taught to students as a means of finding a simple, hey, right answer, or following steps to prove that one side of an equation actually equals another side of the equation.
In her bold new book, Unequal, The Math of When Things Do and Don't Add Up, mathematician and Los Angeles Times Book Prize winner Eugenia Chang challenges our most basic assumptions about sameness. Chang shows that equality is never absolute, not even in math, and that understanding what counts as the same can transform how we think about fairness in the real world. Eugenia, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me back.
First of all, it's so funny. Every time I speak with someone about math or maths, as you say, I always wonder about that very thing. It's mathematics, but when we shorten it in the US to math, when we shorten it, it becomes math. You stick with maths. Why is that?
I've learned to say math now. And I think it's just one of those cultural things that has no particular explanation. But sometimes I just like to say that, well, in the US, we say sports with an S. And in the UK, we say sports. So we have to put the S back somewhere.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of the sport thing. Okay. Well, moving on to math or maths. Tell us about your quest, because this is, I think, maybe the third time we've spoken to you on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, great.
Because you are prolific in coming up with these books that seem to me as though you want to make people out there in the world love math and see the value in it like you do. Tell us about that.
Yes, that is an ongoing and ever increasing quest. And it's not that I want to make everyone love it, but I do want them to see the value in it. And too many people have only seen really boring, rigid math. And I think it's really unfair for them to dislike it based on just having seen that. If they see the parts of math that I think are the most exciting and the most valuable, if they see that and they still don't like it for themselves, that's fair, because we can all like different things. But I hope they can still see the value in it, even if they don't want to spend their whole lives doing it. And I admit that most people won't want to spend their whole lives doing it, even though I do, because I really do love it that much.
And I think I'm going to try to love it eventually. I think what I'm really struggling with is, in the book, you write about how we distinguish between equality and equity. And can you please just spend a moment and explain the difference and why that description is so important when we talk about math?
Well, the words are very tricky in normal life, because we don't start in normal life by making precise definitions like we do in math. And the reason we do it in math is because we want to have clear arguments, and it can make us sound pedantic. Now, equality in math is actually more subtle than it first appears. So yes, 1 = 1, that's not very interesting, is it? 2 = 2, also not very interesting. All the interesting equations have something different about them at the same time as being the same. So, for example, even something as simple as 1 + 3 = 3 + 1, the two sides of that equation are different. We're just deciding what to count as the same and what to count as different. And so even in math, there is that subtlety. In life, it's even more so, because no one is actually equal to anyone else as a person. People are very, very complicated, way more complicated than numbers. And the only person who's actually equal to another person is yourself. Everyone is equal to themselves, and that's it. So what we really mean is, in what way do we want to treat people equally? And what can we do to counteract the previous inequality that has happened to people in their lives? And so I love that there's a cartoon that goes around the internet from time to time showing 3 children trying to watch a ball game over a fence. And one of them is very small, one of them is medium, and one is really tall. And if you treat them all equally, then they all stand on the ground and the short ones can't see over the fence. Whereas if you give the shortest one a taller stool and you give the medium one a medium stool, then their heads all end up at the same position and they can all see over the fence. And so that's a really great example of the difference between equality and equity. And my point of view that I'm trying to put across in this book is that math gives us many, many approaches to dealing with those concepts of sameness and difference. And if we practice those in the world of math, then we get so used to using them that when we look at fairness and unfairness in the world, we have a whole range of tools available to us that we can try using in the world as well.
I love that you're using math to describe fairness, but I kind of want to get back to what actually math is. So, for example, our oldest son, very gifted in math, and when he was in the sixth grade, he was really struggling with a math problem. Now, Eugenia, I thought I was a pretty smart guy at one point, and particularly as a parent, right? You think that you have all the answers for your child. So I said to him, show me the math problem. And I'm looking at the problem on the in the book, and I said to my son, I don't see any numbers. He said, Dad, I haven't done math with numbers since the fourth grade. So can you explain how when we are talking about math, what is the difference of doing math, and particularly how it applies to maybe fairness when sometimes we don't even use numbers?
I'm really impressed that your son had not done math with numbers since fourth grade, because many people only get to do math with numbers for much longer than that. And math does start with numbers, but that's not the end point of it. There are so many more interesting things that we can study in math, including shapes and graphs and logical arguments and different kinds of structures and things with arrows. And the math I do in my research doesn't have any numbers at all and doesn't have any equations either. And I think that math is about using logic to study things that behave according to logic. And the trouble with that is that nothing actually does behave according to logic until you move a little away from objects in the real world and you move into the world of ideas. And that's the process of abstraction, and that's where things do behave according to logic. So numbers are one really good example of that, where we move away from objects and we count them instead, and that's how we get to numbers. We forget the details about what they actually look like. So if we count three bananas and we say that's three, we're forgetting that they're bananas. And then we could have three apples, and when we say three, that three is still three, whether they're bananas or apples or cookies or monkeys or whatever. And so that is the first abstraction that we usually encounter in math. But then there's also shapes. And so if we say that our windows are all rectangles, then we've abstracted away from the windows to the concept of a rectangle, and we've forgotten that it's a rectangle. And then we can go, oh, well, a piece of paper is also a rectangle. And just looking around the things I can see around me, this folder is a rectangle and my pencil tray is a rectangle. And those are all abstractions. And once we start making those connections between different objects that have some things in common, we can then use logic to make general arguments so that we don't have to do the same thing over and over again. If we had to say, oh, one banana plus one banana is two bananas, and then start again with apples and go, oh, one apple plus one apple, that's two apples. And then we try it with cookies and we go, one cookie plus one cookie is two cookies. That gets a bit tedious. And so then we go, okay, we've got a concept of 1 + 1 = 2. And then we can do that with other things like shapes. We can make general arguments about shapes to understand them. And this is where some people complain and they go, why do we spend all this time studying triangles instead of, you know, learning to do our taxes? Because there's no triangle season and there's the tax season comes around. And what I always say is that it's about training our brains to think in a particular way. It's not that we particularly need to analyze triangles in our daily life. I don't know about you, I don't spend very much time analyzing triangles in my daily life, but it's a core training for how to use our brain precisely, how to make careful definitions and how to make logical arguments and accept different things counting as the same in different circumstances.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Eugenia Chang. Her new book is Unequal, The Math of When Things Do and Don't Add Up. Eugenia is a scientist in residence at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. And she has authored so many books, all in my mind about getting people turned on to the concept of math. But as you talk, Eugenia, it makes me wonder about logic and then irrationality. There's so much now in, especially like the news media, so many things that you read that you read because there's been an algorithm that has picked up the way you think, and so it presents you with this stuff. If you're thinking rationally and logically, it's pretty easy to discount a lot of these things that come at us in the news mm-hmm. media. If you apply rationality and logic, it's really easy to see that it can't be true, right? And so I'm just wondering how a mathematician goes through life, and what are your impressions of just the world? Doesn't it drive you crazy the way the news media is these days?
I mean, I think it probably drives everyone crazy, doesn't it? I think everyone's being driven crazy by the news media. And what I take solace in is the fact that I can kind of see what's going on. It drives me crazy when people just sit around yelling at each other about it, because it's there to polarize everybody. And there is clickbait and there's rage bait that is there just to wind people up so that they'll click on it and get into arguments with people, because it's the engagement that counts. And so when I can see that happening, yes, it does drive me a little crazy. But I also try to study it and analyze it and understand it, because I really want to understand all the disagreements we're having. And I did write a book. My third book was called The Art of Logic in an Illogical World. And I've moved a little bit away from that now, because I think it's a great book, but I try not to think of the world as illogical anymore. I try to see the logic in it. And that is what the book was about, really, that was what the title is. But I try to find the logic in everything, because even when someone appears to be being irrational, there's something driving it, and it's usually some strong emotion. So it's often fear. When someone believes in a conspiracy theory, it's often because it validates some fear that they have about something, and that their worldview depends so much on that they want to cling onto it, and that they will then accept any information that validates their fear. And then what I try to do is find a parallel with something in my life. And if I think of things that I'm really afraid of, then I can start to maybe understand that I'll do all sorts of things to validate, especially if someone is telling me that my fear isn't valid, then that makes me want to push back and fight it. And so I am very afraid of, for example, violent death. I mean, who isn't? But some people are more afraid of death than others. And so I will think all sorts of things about, say, getting in a plane. And I know rationally that the statistics about plane crashes mean that it's much safer, statistically speaking, to get in a plane than it is to get in a car. But I was still way more afraid of planes than of cars. And you could say that that's irrational. But I also know that no matter how many people told me it was irrational, and no matter how much I understood the statistics, that would not help me overcome my fear. What I needed to do was understand where the fear was coming from, and then I was able to get over it. So I try to remember that, and remember that telling people they're being irrational rarely helps very much, and understanding what the logic is behind their thought may be more helpful.
That is such a great point as well, and I hope it helps our listeners. I know you're a concert pianist, and one of the illustrations that we can picture pretty well is you talk about in your book, and it is the notes. That was so great. Yeah. I'm not a musician, but that made so much sense to me. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I love that example of notes that sound like they're the same note, even though they're at different octaves. And so even if you don't know very much about music, maybe you can hear, if I sing this note, la, and this note, la, 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 they're kind of the same note at different octaves. And so we call them an octave apart, and we typically call them the same name in Western classical music. So A, I don't have perfect pitch, so I'm just going to pick a random note and so go la, I don't know, maybe that's a D, and then this is also a D. There's no way that's a D. Someone's going to be sitting at a piano and writing in going, this isn't a D. Let's say that's an E, 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 E. And those are all called E, although they're at different pitches. And then the reason that we hear them the same is because of the math of wavelengths. And so if you double the frequency of an, every pitch has a wave shape, which has a frequency, and it's the frequency that at which the wave oscillates that tells us how we hear the pitch. So if we double it, because those two waves feel similar and they can oscillate in resonance with each other. It's like if you're walking up the street and somebody else is walking with a footfall that's exactly twice as fast, then you'll stay in step, because one person will just put their feet down twice as fast, but you'll still be in step. And if they do it three times as fast, you'll still be in step. But if someone's doing it at some weird ratio, then it will be wonky, and then you won't be able to walk up the road in step. So because those waves oscillate kind of in step, we hear them very similarly. So we call them all E, even though they're also at different pitches. And that can be confusing, but it can also be lovely. And each wave has a whole harmonic series inside it. So if you play any note on an instrument, it's not just a sine wave. It has different waves embedded in it at different frequencies, giving it the richness and the resonance. But our brain sort of blends them all together into one wave. And if you separate them out using some kind of spectral analysis, you can see the different waves contributing to it, which I find fascinating. But then our brain puts them all together into one. And so there are different E's according to different instruments and different ways of singing. So if I sing la, maybe that sounds nicer. I don't know. Let's not judge it. But if I go la, then maybe that sounds kind of terrible. And they're still the same note, but they have different timbres. And so those two waves, if we put them through an analysis on an oscilloscope, one of them would probably be rounder and the other one would be much more jagged, but they would have the same frequency. So there's some sense in which they're the same and some other senses in which they're different. And so when we're playing music, there are lots of different ways of playing the same notes. And sometimes people think that playing classical music is really boring because you're always playing the same notes over and over again. But there are many different ways to play them. So it depends whether you care about the different ways to play the same notes or you just want to hear different notes every time. And so in every day in life, we make these decisions about what we're going to count as the same and what we're going to count as different. If we go into a coffee shop and we buy a cookie, then maybe we don't care which cookie we get, but maybe we don't want a double chocolate chip cookie and we actually want a raisin oatmeal cookie. And maybe we don't want any old raisin oatmeal cookie. We want this particular one because that's the one that looks like it's got the squashiest center or something. So it depends how picky we're feeling. And some people are less picky than others. As we grow up, we probably become more accepting. Small children notoriously may want one particular piece of chocolate cake that they see in the window, not the other pieces of chocolate cake that all look the same to adults, who then go, well, why are you so upset about the different pieces of chocolate cake? And so all the time in life, we make these maybe subconscious decisions about which differences matter to us in which circumstances. And in different circumstances, different differences will matter. Most of the time, it probably doesn't matter if you need to cover for somebody at work. Most of the time, it shouldn't matter what you look like, unless perhaps you're being a body double for them in a movie, in which case maybe it does matter what they look like. And we do this subconsciously all the time. And what I think is wonderful about math is it brings those things into our consciousness so that we're aware of the choices we're making, so that we can make them more carefully and take responsibility for them. And that's what I wish we would do in life as well. Make conscious choices about what we're counting the same and different, choose carefully, and then take responsibility for our choices.
Wow. Well, as someone who's getting on a plane tomorrow, now I have a lot to think about. Thanks for that. But let's go back to the title or subtitle of your book, The Math of When Things Do and Don't Add Up. And I'm still thinking about the whole 1+1 conundrum that we were talking about and a way of using math maybe in, you know, what is equal and what's right and how do we use math maybe to measure fairness in a society where we often argue over whether systems are fair. From a mathematical point of view, is fairness something we can actually measure, or is it always going to be partly subjective?
Well, there's always going to be some point at which we have to decide what measures we're going to use. And what I think is that we should acknowledge that there are different measures, and then we should carefully discuss which measures we're using rather than just accusing each other of not being fair, because there are different ways to be fair. For example, for just something simple like taxation, there are flat taxes where everyone pays the same number of dollars as their taxes. But then there's another version where everyone pays the same percentage of their income. And then there's the version where people think that people with more income should pay more percentage. And so those are three just very basically different versions that can count as fair in different circumstances. And one of the examples I give in the book, I talk about the concept of metric spaces in mathematics. And metric spaces are a way of measuring shapes, where you have a concept of distance between two points. But it doesn't have to be straightforward distance. It might be something like you take into account traffic flow. And so when you're doing Google Maps and you're trying to plan how you're going to drive to somewhere, maybe you want to pick the fastest route, and then it will show you which is the fastest, which might be longer in terms of distance because of the traffic. But maybe you want the cheapest one, so you want to avoid the tolls, and that might be longer in terms of distance and longer in terms of time, but less in terms of money. And so you pick which metrics you're going to take into account. Or maybe you're walking and you don't want to go so far uphill. Or maybe you're on a knee scooter because you broke your foot, and then you want to go up slopes and not in places where there are staircases. And so it really just depends. And so when we're measuring how far someone has come in life, as we often are if they're applying for a job or they're applying to get into university or something like that, we're trying to evaluate their achievements up to now in order to predict their achievements in the future at a basic level. And if one person has always been running uphill or against the wind all the time, facing obstructions the whole time, then maybe we should measure that differently from somebody who has always had the wind behind them and tons of support. So, for example, some people come from families where no one has ever been to university before, and they don't believe in university, and they spend their whole childhood telling them that they shouldn't go to university because it's a waste of time and it's not for them. Other people, and I came from a family where it was just completely expected that I would go to university, and so every possible support was given to help me get into university. Those are two very different experiences, and those people may end up sitting next to each other. And this is the beginning of the semester for many people now, and I meet my new students, and I know that people who are sitting next to each other in my classroom have had very different journeys to get there. So very literally, some of them come from Chicago. English is their first language. They know their way around the city. Some people have come from halfway around the world. They've never left their home country before. English is their second language. They don't know anybody there. That's a much harder experience for them. And so then the question is, should we take that into account? And what I do believe is that we all have a right to decide, but we should actually make that choice consciously. And if we're not going to help people who've had a harder time up until that point, then we should acknowledge that and take responsibility for it. And as you may be able to tell, I believe in helping people who have had a harder journey up to that point. And I'm not going to tell anyone else what to do, but I think that if we're going to make a different decision, then we should just sit down and acknowledge that we're using a different metric, and then we can have a sensible, maybe sensible, more sensible conversation about which choices we're making and why.
All right, well, let's take that one step further then. We live in this digital age, in a world increasingly shaped by algorithms, if you will. So how do these ideas about inequity in math apply to questions of bias in, say, artificial intelligence and machine learning, where you just talked about equity and inequity in the classroom, or how people meet or sitting next to each other in the different worlds they may come from. But now we're living in this world of artificial intelligence. Does inequity in math play into the algorithms that we're now dealing with?
Well, unfortunately, and I'm not an expert in AI, but as far as I understand it, because AI trains on the data coming from the world, it builds in and it picks up the biases that are in the world. And one example, and maybe somebody should fact check me because I read this on the internet, so it might not be true, but one example I read was about self-driving cars that were trained on particular kinds of data, and it turned out that they were much better at recognizing people in the street if they were white, and that they were not very good at recognizing black people in the street. Now, I can't remember where I read that, but that kind of, if that's true, then that is something that is built into the models, and that it is something that if we feel responsible about it, then we should try to counteract that, because I think that would be terrible if the self-driving cars couldn't spot a person who was black and therefore crashed into that person. And you could say, oh, well, that wasn't my fault because that was just how the algorithm was trained. Or you could take responsibility for fighting that kind of bias and try to make the system change itself. They may have already done that now. I read this a few years ago, but that is an example where I think that we should find those problems and correct for them, just like any other unfairness that we have seen happen in the world in the past. We should correct for it now, even though it would be better. Yes, it would be better for the unfairness never to have occurred in the first place. And one day, if we're in utopia and everybody has equal access to resources and support all the way from birth, then maybe we'll never have to address those things later, because everyone will have had wonderful support at every point. And so when I meet my students and they arrive, everyone will already have been treated equally and I won't have to do anything about it. But I think we're pretty far off that situation.
Indeed. Eugenia Chang has joined us today. As a mathematician, she's challenging our most basic assumptions about sameness in her new book, Unequal, The Math of When Things Do and Don't Add Up. Boy, it really, the next time I hear someone say, all things being equal, as many people do, like, why do we say that to begin yeah. with? I mean, I'm guilty of the same, all things being equal.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those verbal tics, and I'm going to do it now myself, but like when people say like all the time in a sentence, to just put off getting to your point because you're still trying to think about it, or when people say, well, to play devil's advocate, or something like that. All things being equal, yes, indeed. All
things, it's a nice and long verbal tick.
Yes. All things are never equal. And so while it may be true that all things being equal, something, 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 well, they're not. So let's acknowledge that they're not equal and decide what we're going to do about it. Of course, I have met people who really cling to the idea that there isn't any inequality and so we don't need to do anything about it. And that's mm-hmm. a pretty difficult conversation to get into. And actually, I admit, I had an argument like that, and that was one of the catalysts for writing this book.
Eugenia Chang, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure and a challenge.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio. Thanks to our guest, Jen Schwartz, senior editor at Scientific American, who discussed moments in history when science has reversed itself, and Eugenia Chang, who explains why equality isn't always mathematically equal.
And tune in next week when our guests are author and digital restoration expert Andy Saunders, who takes us inside Gemini and Mercury Remastered. Oh, I love this conversation. So interesting. Such a beautiful book. Also, physicists Sanjita Marukar and Rowan Thompson, who share how their team is combining physics, health sciences, and bioinformatics to create more precise, personalized treatments for cancer patients. And thanks again for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode and past episodes on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app. Hey, if you like this episode, rate us and share it with a friend. And if you have a great suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us, please, at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.